Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back. It's the Gulf Coast, Alabama, Sunday morning. And it's July. It's, you know, it's supposed to be wet. Leanna, it's supposed to be humid. It's about as humid on the Gulf Coast as it can be in any July. I don't think it can get more humid than a normal July on the Gulf Coast. It is raining more, though. And the rain's a little different this year. Sometimes we get these things, and it's the rain is happening all across the state. I think people all across the state are beginning to appreciate what July in Mobile is like. Rain. Lots of rain coming in. Looks like we'll have a little more, maybe a little bit of a dry out. It's an unusual situation, a little cooler than normal perhaps, but very humid, and there's no consolation. I know that it's cooler when it is as humid as it is. It's just life on the Gulf Coast. There are things that survive all this. There are things that do well in all of this. We can talk about those things. We always do. It's Gulf summer. And people have been living with Gulf summer for a long time. It can be a great time of year. It's a fun time of year. Let's enjoy it. Hey, we got some garden things to think about today, and I encourage your calls. I have been thinking a lot about weeds lately, and I think solving the problem of gardening, solving the problems of farming in Alabama. Oh, everybody's got some kind of hokey solution for how to fix farming in Alabama when nobody really understands what the problems are. I'm afraid. Not even I do. We got a lot of issues with Alabama that we're just beginning to explore. But, you know, I do think I understand that farming and gardening, the key, one of the big keys to doing them well and to succeeding in Alabama is figuring out what to do about weeds. They're a big part of what drives gardening, and we do crazy things. You know, I've in the past, we tore the soil to pieces, and some still do. And with tillers, and turning the soil over and over and over again, because it's the only way they can imagine to deal with weeds. And it just makes the weeds worse, because every time you turn the soil, you increase the number of weed seeds that come to the surface, and thus they germinate, and then you have to till again. And in the process, you destroy the soil. This is what's happened all over Alabama. Our soil, which was, it was old soil, I admit, for the most part. But a lot of it was good soil, and we could have maintained it for a long, long time. We just tore it to pieces by trying to fight weeds in the most crude way possible. So then at some point we realized, God, we aren't going to have any topsoil left, so let's figure out how to do no-till. No-till is a great idea, and I recommend it. It's just that in order to do no-till, the only way people could imagine doing it was chemicals. Now, that's not the only way to do it. We talk about other ways to do it on this show all the time, and so they used chemicals all the time to try to wipe out all the weeds so that they wouldn't have to till the soil. And it works to a certain degree, except that the weeds become resistant to the chemicals. And more importantly, there's only a certain number of crops that you can use. So if you ever wonder why, we have a monument to the boll weevil in where is it, Enterprise or down in the Wiregrass, because the boll weevil supposedly made Alabama's agriculture more diverse by getting us off cotton. Well, it didn't do that, did it? It actually, we're now stuck on three crops: corn, cotton, and soybeans. And the reason we do those crops almost exclusively is because they're the only crops that we really have a way to spray herbicide over them. They're herbicide resistant crops. And so we use those crops over and over again, not because we're particularly good at growing them. We aren't. We aren't productive in any of those crops compared to other places. Cotton, a little better, but not much. Corn, we don't even come close. Soybeans, we don't even come close to where the rest of the country is in terms of productivity, particularly in the big corn and soybean belts. But the reason we grow them is because they're the only seeds we can find that produce herbicide-resistant plants. So we can spray our herbicide over them. It's weeds. It drives everything we do. And we come up with these crazy solutions that just put us in a bind, that just make our agriculture this sort of dog chasing its tail absurd thing. So what do we do about that? I don't know. I'm thinking about it a lot. There are a lot of ways around it. But you know, I'll also tell you, it's becoming obvious to me, too, that a lot of the weeds we create seem to be getting worse. A lot of the weeds seem to be getting worse. And, you know, you'll think, oh, why are weeds getting worse? Well, it's not so much that the weeds are getting worse. It's that we're getting worse. I'm serious. We have become everything. We are doing everything we can to produce super weeds, and we don't think about it. And it's causing us big problems. So in the midst of all of this sort of ancient weed problem that people have always had since Adam, and people will always probably have some type of weed problem, it's just inevitable. But we've made things so much worse, and people make it worse every day. What's the big way? Well, one way, and I'll have to say, we're very predictable. We've made it easy for weeds to predict what's going to happen. And you'd think weeds aren't smart, but they're smarter than most folks, I'll have to say. They take advantage of you all the time because they know your habits. And here's the interesting thing. People are predictable all across the world now. Everybody does things in the same way. It's amazing. They grow the same crops in the same ways. They mow their grasses now. Everybody's got to mow their lawn exactly the same way. They manage their yards the same way. They try to grow the same plants in the same places with the same techniques. So it didn't used to be that way, by the way. We had different crops. We had different gardening techniques. We had different standards for what mowing was about. But we're changing the face of the globe in a consistent way across the globe. And that means if there's a crazy weed out there that's going to be really go berserk, it's going to really go berserk because it's just got like free reign. Every place is the same. And everybody says, oh, I know this. I've done this before. I can do it again here. I can do it in another place. And so it spreads quickly. It's predictable. We are predictable. That's one thing we can fix. And it's something to think about. It's something to think about as we move forward on weeds. But here's the other problem. We've become globetrotters. And weeds are globetrotting now in ways that they've never been able to globetrot before. So you could have some obscure weed, some crazy little weed that's not causing any problem in some weird climate over in Tajikistan. And it wasn't an issue at all. But suddenly we have brought it out and we have taken it all around the globe. We've given it every opportunity. We've taken it on jets. We take it in airplanes. We take it in shipping crates. We take it in our suitcases when we travel. It goes all around the planet. Seeds, roots. As we move plants around, all of these things, they move around the planet. A lot of times, and just sometimes by accident, if only by accident, these weeds can find a place, and they find the perfect place, and then they go berserk. So they may find, boy, I really like Alabama. There's plenty of rain here, a lot more rain than where I grew up. There's not any of the pests that I used to have where I grew up. Man, this is the place. I'm going to settle here. This is the place. And so it becomes a super weed. But there's another thing we're doing too, and we're going to talk about it when we get back. We're selecting for the worst weeds. We deliberately choose the worst weeds. We'll be back to talk about that.
You can take all the tea in China. Put it in a big brown.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Plain Gardening. Hey, we were talking about weeds, and we're talking about why weeds are getting worse, and we're kind of getting down to the point where it actually settles on us, and some things we can do. Let me tell you, there were three stages here. There were three stages, and the first stage is that we're all very predictable. That's something you can deal with. We are creating uniform conditions across the globe that allow weeds to move from one place to another very well. And the second thing is that we're globetrotters. We find obscure plants in obscure places, and we move them around the globe. We sometimes do it by accident. But here's the other thing, and this is really important. We often don't do it by accident. We often do it on purpose. And the worst weeds that you have to deal with almost inevitably are weeds that people deliberately introduced. And so it's interesting to think, why did we do something like that? Why are we selecting for the worst weeds? And here's an interesting thing to think about, and something interesting you should think about when you choose plants and when you choose what you put in your garden. We want plants that are invincible. We want plants that we don't have to think about. We want plants that are easy, not just easy, but super easy. Things that just sort of spread uncontrollably so that we don't have to deal with them. And this is one of our problems. And it explains things like, well, Kogon grass. And Kogon grass is a terrible thing. It's really hard to deal with. People think that nature's going to take, it won't take care of Kogon grass. I'll tell you, we're going to have to deal with it ourselves before it eats us alive. We'll have to talk more about how to do that. But Kogon grass has turned out to be something really terrible. It's in a lot of yards. And the reason it's in a lot of yards, it was introduced through the Port of Mobile, and it would have spread slowly, but then people who had cattle decided, oh man, this is so easy to grow. Maybe we could just put it in our pastures, and we did. And then the cows wouldn't eat it that well because it hardened up too quickly during the summer, but it kept spreading. And then the highway department said, well, gosh, this is a great ground cover for our highways. It was really easy to manage because it spread like wildfire, and so they moved it all up and down the highways on purpose and not on purpose. It all seemed fine, and now it's everywhere, and it's a huge issue. Same with privet. We introduced it as an ornamental because it was really easy, really easy. Same with Bermuda grass, same with fescue, same with tallow trees and popcorn trees. The same with Japanese climbing fern. You're going to see some other weeds coming along. I'm going to tell you. I warn you. And they're going to look so tempting because they're so easy and they're so aggressive, and people can give them away because they're always going to have more than they need and more maybe even than they want. And so they're going to give you these. It's really easy. You don't have to think about this plant. It's just going to grow itself. Wigelia, is one of those plants. Wigelia. Some people call it Singapore daisy, even though it's from Central America and South America. But in this climate, it goes berserk. it just spreads everywhere. It's impossible to control. Pretty little yellow daisy, very close to the ground. Dark evergreen leaves, but you won't have anything else in your garden. It just becomes impossible to deal with. It's becoming a huge issue in lawns. So it's good to think about, sometimes we want things to be too easy, and we always suffer for it. We're creating super weeds, and we need to think about it as we approach weeding. Be careful about what you introduce. And I frequently get pictures of plants, people saying, "What is this? It's really pretty." And I want to say, "Oh man, please don't put that in your garden, because you're going to be calling me back in a year and saying, ooh." It's nice for things to be easy. It's not good for things to be super easy. It can be simple. It can be, but you have to be thoughtful about what you do in your yard. We create the weeds that we have, almost all of them. We create them. We have to look at ourselves if we're going to figure out how to deal with weeds. It's just one of those things. One of those things. And some weeds we create, they're so bad that we really don't have an easy way of dealing with them. Cogon grass is one of those. And it's a weed that's been selected by humans for a long time. Selected because it is easy to grow and easy to move around. And we moved it around in some pretty ferocious ways. Now we got a big problem to deal with. And we're working on it. We're thinking about it. But we don't need more problems like that. We need to be thinking about what we have as weeds in our yards and how to prevent them from happening. Well, let's think about that. How do we deal with these? How do we become less predictable? That's an interesting question. You know, it's a lot of weeds in our yard. And I'll tell you this. Let's start at the beginning with some of these weeds. Let me remind you that the way you mow is going to determine the weeds in your yard. It's going to determine whether you have the weed that is St. Augustine, which is a type of grass, or whether you have weeds of other types. And so you have to think about how does my mowing affect what I have in my yard? And it's a pretty interesting thing. You know, mowing, we have taken some of our native weeds, some of our native plants, which weren't weeds at all. In fact, people barely even knew what to call them. Like Virginia buttonweed, which was a nice food for quail, nice wildlife plant, pretty rare, pretty obscure, only grew in certain places. But we moved it around in sod because we could move sod. We took sod from landscapers, took sod from areas that were a little moist, and it had some Virginia buttonweed in it, and we moved it around to all of these places we've never had before, and then we irrigate the lawns to create perfect conditions, and then we mow very close, which created ideal conditions for Virginia buttonweed to compete with St. Augustine grass. And so this little innocuous plant that really wasn't, you couldn't describe it as a weed at all because it wasn't that common, it just suddenly it becomes this nightmare for everybody who wants their pure lawns without anything but grass in them, because you're never going to get rid of Virginia buttonweed. But it's something we chose. It's something we did. It's something that is a result of actions we took. And we can begin to control those things, too. It's smart to think about that. How do you control Virginia buttonweed? Thinking about how you mow is important. Thinking about how we move weeds around. Sometimes it's good to pull Virginia buttonweed. Just pull it out of the yard. It's the best way of dealing with it. We can talk about that. Herbicides are not very effective against it. It's one of those weeds we pulled out of the woods, and it manages to. Herbicides aren't very smart, and this weed tends to dodge those herbicides pretty well. So it's an interesting thing. One of the things is being less predictable in how you mow. Don't mow exactly like your neighbors are mowing. They're all mowing way too close for the most part. You can mow your lawn higher. That'll help save you a lot of problems. And then, you know, here's another thing. And I want to say this over and over again. If you create a large uniform lawn around your house of many acres or of a half acre or 1 acre, you are inviting weed problems because there are so many other habitats. It's the universal symbol. A lawn is the universal symbol for weeds. They know how to take advantage of lawns. And so by making our lawns bigger and bigger and bigger, we're making more habitat for weeds. And it's easier for them to spread around. You don't have to mow everything. And we can talk about the alternatives to mowing. And there should be alternatives to mowing. But mowing has become one of our most predictable activities as gardeners. And weeds are taking advantage of that. Just something to think about. Hey, let's talk about your yard today. Let's talk about what to do with all this rain. And how to deal with your vegetables. What kind of flowers to grow. What kind of things to plant. July is a transition time, and we got to start planning now for the cool weather. Isn't that a nice thing to do when it's this hot? Give us a call, 251-343-0106. There's a trunk in the corner. I keep all my letters, my bills, and the man's a kid too.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. I hope your figs are doing well. It's that time, you know, it's better when it doesn't rain too much during the peak of fig season. And so I hope we get some breaks in time for the figs. I know that figs always hit about the 1st of July along the Gulf Coast, a little later as you move up. What a great privilege to be able to eat figs. And I will tell you, particularly this time of year, when it's this humid and it's this wet, the best way to enjoy figs is to go out to the tree and pick them yourself and eat them right there at the tree. Because the best figs are going to be very soft. They don't get sweeter when you pick them and bring them in. They're going to be very soft. So you need to pick them when they're very soft. But the problem is, when it's this humid and there's this much moisture, they're not going to hold up that well, honestly, for long storage. So if you just eat them right there... It's just fun. Just, you know, maybe take some cream out to the tree. Just take a little bowl of cream. You can just dip it in the cream. Or whip it up if you want to do something special. Just dip it in there and eat them right there at the tree. Just take a chair and a table out to the tree and do it. That's one way of doing it. So Rusty is saying, can he cut back and transplant after they're through? Yeah, you know you can, Rusty. And I would say... He wants to share his figs, and he's got, I can't tell which ones. Those may be magnolia. They're pretty big. Do you know which one that one is, Rusty? It's a big fig. Some of the big figs sometimes get a little rotten because their eye is too big, and so they get more junk in them. But if you're doing really well and you want to share it, there's a lot of ways of doing it. One of the things I would do, Rusty, it's really simple. While it's green, is to just... If you can find some limbs that are kind of springy and just lay them down and throw LSU Gold, good. Yeah, that's a good one. Just lay it on the ground and throw some dirt over it. Throw some straw over it or dirt over it. It'll root, and you can probably cut it in multiple places. You see what I'm saying? Just layer it. That's really good. But it'll also put out sprouts around the base, and you can cut those off. This tree, I don't see a lot of sprouts. It's probably because you're mowing pretty close to it, and some of the sprouts probably may have gotten cut back, or maybe it's just too young. But I don't see a lot of sprouts that you can take off easily. So I think you might need to layer it first. Layer it. You see what I'm saying? Lay those branches down. That's what we mean by layering. Lay those branches down. Pull some of the flimsier branches down to the ground. put some dirt over them and let them root, and they will do it. The other way to do it is to, you know, I don't think it works as well with green cuttings, but it works pretty good in fall and winter. When they've lost their leaves, you can get the hardwood cuttings, so-called hardwood cuttings, the not the green growth, but the wood that's lost its leaves already. We'll just call that a hardwood cutting. And you just take some tips, maybe a couple of feet, 18 inches of branch, and just put them in a leaf bed with moldery leaves and let them sit there over winter, and they're going to root out. And you'll have tons. You'll have tons. That's another way of doing it. But I think right now, if you want to do it now, you're going to have to layer them, because I don't see enough sprouts coming up from the base. Rusty, if that ain't making any sense, you need to call me and ask me, what in the world are you talking about? What in the world are you talking about? John, I love talking about American holly. Let's do.
Bill, I got a problem. Hurricane Zeta came through, and I've got this 35, 40-year-old American holly tree. It's gorgeous. Had 30-plus feet tall, teardrop shape. Gorgeous, and it knocked it on its side, but it's still alive, and I don't want to cut it. Is there a way that I can put it back upright and have it still, you know, take root and salvage it?
Yeah. So how long has this been on the ground? Tell me again, how long has it been leaning?
Almost a year now, since Hurricane Zeta came through.
Yeah. Yeah, so, boy, that's going to be a tough one, because it's already put out new roots, and that's why it's surviving. And when you lift it up, you're going to tear all those new roots. You're going to tear them to pieces. You see what I'm saying?
Right. The surviving, the one side of it, there was two major roots on the left and the north and south side of it. The south side broke. The north side one is still strong, and that's what's kept it alive. But I'm afraid if I were to, like you said, if I try to upright it, it would break the northern one and the new one.
Yeah, that's right. So, yeah, it's sometimes if you. So I don't recommend doing this on fast growing trees. And the good thing about American holly is it isn't a fast growing tree, so it's not going to do damage to your house if it falls. And that's good, because sometimes they don't repair themselves well after this kind of thing. So in theory, you could tip it back up. I'm a little worried about doing it this late. How much of an angle? How bad of an angle is it?
Oh, it's parallel to the ground.
Yeah,
I know. I love this tree. It's my favorite tree. Well, that's the only reason I haven't cut it so far. Cause I wanted it to die, and it wouldn't. It's still putting out berries, and the wildlife is still in there like they always have been. The birds are enjoying it. They're nesting. Everything's in there. It's just laying on its side.
So it's going to let's talk about what it's going to do if you don't do anything. Let's think about it. And here's what's going to happen. And it's going to make some accommodations to where it is and to life as it is. And I don't know whether you can make these accommodations too, but the tree's going to figure it out. So a lot of those branches on the sides that are just branches will actually become dominant, and they'll grow up just as if they're trees. You see what I'm saying?
Wow.
And they're going to grow straight up.
Yeah.
And, you know,
it's not going to have that same shape as it did before, that teardrop shape. I mean, this thing was huge. It was the biggest one I've seen in Mobile.
Yeah. Life changes. Things change.
Yeah.
I don't think you're going to get the teardrop shape back. I worry about lifting the tree back up, because I think it will do damage, particularly with it sitting over that much. But the tree is likely to survive for quite a while. After a while, you may be able to choose one of those branches as the upright branch, and maybe it's one that's close to the trunk. And let it get started again. It's going to grow pretty fast. And then you can begin gradually trimming away the other branches that are growing upright.
So basically let it start life new from the trunk, one of the limbs, and then groom it to where that one limb is going to be the new tree.
And it's going to be a lifetime project. I won't kid you. It will take a while because American hollies don't grow that fast. But
right.
It will preserve the tree. And I don't think I worry about pulling that tree back upright. I mean, I guess if somebody brought in a tree spade, and it would be very hard to do it with a tree spade, and you could make a big enough thing, you could lift it up and reseat the whole thing. But boy, is that going to be a lot of trouble. And it would be really hard, particularly with a tree that old. And
yeah.
I just don't think it's going to survive just being pushed back up.
I didn't think so either. I'll do what you say. I recommend it here. I'll wait to see one limb that's going to be dominant and work around that one.
John, send me a picture. And let me look at it. Send me a picture. And you can just text it right to this number.
I will, Bill. Thanks, man.
Thank you.
Bye.
Alan?
Hey.
How are you doing?
I'm fine. How are you?
Good.
So I have a question. We just went on a 2-week vacation, and of course, while we were gone, my rattlesnake green beans got huge, and I guess the bottom line is, can you shell them and eat them?
Yes.
Okay.
Quite good that way.
Okay.
And I often do, because, you know, you miss some, you know, and
right.
you go away and, yeah, but they're actually quite good as shelly beans, as the old term was shelly beans, and they'll make a nice, good shelly bean. And, you know, you can dry it, but I don't dry it. Just put it in. And you know, here's the thing. When I was growing up, we just threw the shelly beans, the shelled beans, and the whole green bean in the same pot.
Well, and my mother used to do that. But what I'm left with now is mostly the shelly beans. So,
and that's fine.
I'm thinking about making a pot of just the beans, and how would you cook them?
Not too much.
Okay.
Listen, they'd be great as, you know, you just kind of do them. You want them to have a little bite when you bite into them. You don't want them to be mushy.
Right.
And you'll have to play with that. Here's a couple of ways to do it. You make a great salad bean, for example. You
Ooh.
Know, serve them. They would actually be great cold mixed in with a salad. And to do that, I would just boil them just a little bit and maybe season them a little bit and then put them in a salad. Be great. Here, another way I do it, when I have beans like that, it's just like I would do any green bean. You can blanch them really quickly. I think it probably helps to blanch. Just blanch them. You know what I'm saying? Put them in some boiling water. Blanch them for maybe, no more than 30 seconds. And maybe even a little less, but about blanch them really hot water, 30 seconds. Take them out, put them in a frying pan.
Oh, yeah.
put them in the frying pan. You don't have to put oil in there. Let them get a little toasty, just a little bit toasty. And that's kind of the nice part. They'll get a little bit toasty in that pan as they're heating up. Then add the oil and then add the spices and stir fry them. And they are so good that way.
Great. I mean, I have a huge amount of them. So.
Oh, that's going to be great.
Yeah, that sounds...
And
I figured you could, but I just, you know, hadn't done it before.
Yeah. And how long do you do it? I don't know. you kind of figure it out. But 30 seconds in the hot water, 30 seconds in the boiling water, that'll break them down just a little bit, and then put them in the skillet. Let the hot skillet, you don't even have to have oil if it's a black skillet, just put them in there. And then after they begin to sizzle and after they get a little bit brown on the edges, get a little bit of char on the edges, then put your oil in.
Okay. That sounds
really good
great.
That way. Yeah.
Thank you.
All right, Ellen. Good to talk to you.
You too.
Tell me how they turn out.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Oh, I love this music.
to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning. Alabama Sunday morning. Hope you're doing well. Hope you got David Hubble sends me these pictures. Makes me hungry. So David says his Louisiana purple beans have been doing real well. And his green eggplant from Louisiana is doing real well. Beautiful looking stuff. Good looking stuff. And then he sends me a picture. How I'm dealing with the bounty from the garden of Creole tomato basil pie and sear roasted pork chops with balsamic fig sauce, if that sounds really good. So, David, I can't tell how much the sear roasted pork chops are outside the pie, I assume. But tell me what's in the pie. And if you somehow have all of that in the pie, I want to know about it. It looks like you almost have some figs in there. But tell me what's in that pie. Tomato pie, a great thing to do this time of year with some of those late tomatoes as they come in. If you're getting a lot of them, if you still have a few, you're probably not going to get a lot more along the immediate Gulf Coast. You'll probably do a little better farther inland where night temperatures won't get quite as hot. But you might have this last little glut. Tomato pie is a thing, man. It's a thing. And if you can make a great crust, and I'll have to say, I'm just going to say it. My wife makes a great crust. She makes a great pie crust. If you can make a great pie crust and put that in there, make a pie out of it. It is something else. It is something else, having a tomato pie. You know, it's, how do you describe it, David? It's just like, it's like what pizza wants to be and never can quite achieve, right? It's an amazing thing. Tomato pie. Tomato basil pie. Great thing. David, tell me exactly what's in it. I just want to know. Alicia sent me some pictures of her ahi sugar rush peach. Ahi is one of those South American names, Central American names for pepper. One of the chili peppers that are, and in this case, it's a bacatum pepper, I believe. That is not like the annuum peppers that we grow from Mexico, not like bell peppers, not like jalapenos. It's more of a, they're more humidity tolerant and they do really great. And they're beautiful little peppers. She chose to grow one ahi sugar rush peach, which is not that hot, right? I think it's not as hot as some of the others. It's a really mild pepper, but it can be really good and a lot of fun to grow. And it did really well, and it doesn't get the tomato wilt, doesn't get that wilt like tomatoes do. She lost all of her tomatoes to wilt. And I will tell you, folks, in a climate like ours, where it rains all the time, you really do have to be prepared for wilt. And we... If any of you had lost your tomatoes to wilt, you give me a call. We'll talk about it. I think I've talked to Alicia about it. But you have to create new soil. That's the way to do it, and that's the way I've done it. And so create a compost pile where you want to grow your tomatoes. That's the way to grow tomatoes here. I always started out that way. I start with a compost pile where I want to grow my new crop of tomatoes, and I just let that compost pile just molder down to create a new level of soil, and it will be well-drained, which makes it very hard for tomato wilt to develop, and it's almost like the tomato wilt gets buried a little bit too. I think that may happen just a little bit. It's not mobilized in the top part of the soil where most of the roots are. So it really helps. It's made all the difference in the world, for me. Zinnia's leggy. Oh, they love that sunlight. They need the sunlight. But I think they're going to do okay. I think you're doing all right. They're looking good. I don't think you need to fertilize. Given Alicia asked me, I think the question is, do I need to fertilize? And I will tell you, if you're using a standard potting mix from, you know, any of those places, they already have fertilizer in them. Too much. And one of the reasons your plants are leggy is because they have too much fertilizer. Seedlings don't need a lot of fertilizer, and that's a big problem. That is a big problem with a lot of the mixes out there, is that they have too much fertilizer for the seedlings, and so they tend to get a, that's one of the reasons why they tend to get a little leggy. So no, do not add fertilizer. They got plenty of fertilizer unless you've got some kind of soil mix you made yourself. They will have too much fertilizer. So Alicia, just make sure they get plenty of sunlight. Don't let them get all tangled up. Go ahead and plant them out pretty soon. So David is giving me this recipe. I'm going to look at it very carefully. Yeah, half a cup of chopped andouille. That makes sense. You know, it's really good. He's got five tomatoes. This is his tomato pie. A little tomato pie in a little tin. Five tomatoes, half a cup of fresh basil leaves, half a cup of chopped andouille, half thinly sliced onion, half cup cheddar, one cup of Monterey Jack. He's got the recipe on YouTube. I'm going to look at this. I'm going to look at that recipe on YouTube. David does these kinds of things. You ought to follow David if you get a chance. I'm going to give you all that information just as soon as David resends it to me about how to follow David. Because he's got great stuff, great ideas, beautiful plants, beautiful, beautiful pies. And he thinks about what he's doing. It's good to have David as a listener and good to have David as somebody who provides us great information. Ted is asking me, are there any native elderberries in this area? Oh, boy, Ted, you betcha. You betcha. You betcha. We got all kind of native elderberries. You probably have some growing in your yard, and you're probably knocking them down as weeds. They can be pretty weedy here, but they're really great. The fruits are great. I think we don't understand elderberries very, very well in Alabama. And I'm making a case out of this, and people get tired of the botanists to get tired of me talking about it. But I'm telling you, there's some weird-looking elderberries in Alabama. But they all have good fruit. I think we mostly have the Caribbean version of the elderberry along the Gulf Coast. It's smooth. It's got smooth stems. It grows like a weed. I mean, it really does grow. It's incredibly prolific. If you don't mow everything, you're going to see some, more than likely. The birds are, the birds like to spread it around the way birds do. It's because they love the berries. And so it's a great thing. Lots of native elderberries. We have a great one. And it's the Caribbean strain, mostly along the Gulf Coast. As you move farther north, I think we have other strains, maybe even some that are kind of hadn't been named yet. I'm thinking about this. It's kind of bizarre what we're seeing in terms of differences in elderberries. Oh, the taxonomists are going to drive them crazy. But they're weird looking things, but they're beautiful things. Elderberries. We have our little elderberry music. We forget about how important elderberries are. I think it's one of our great lost fruits. One of our great lost fruits. Judy, goodness gracious, what did I do, Judy? Hold on. We're going to be right back and we're going to talk about knockout roses. I'm so sorry I didn't get to you this hour, but we got another hour. Hold on or call back. And we'll talk about your knockouts next hour.
Sitting on the front porch, cooling in the shed, singing every song the radio played, waiting for the Alabama.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
All right, welcome back. It's a Gulf Coast Sunday morning. It's an Alabama Sunday morning. There's a lot of rain out there, a lot more rain coming. It's going to change the way you have to think about your gardening, particularly as the nights get really warm. It's not the daytime temperatures that affect your garden. It's the nighttime temperatures that affect your garden. It's a really important thing to learn about gardening. If you really want to understand seasons, you need to understand that it's often the nighttime temperatures that make the seasons, not the daytime temperatures. And that's true in winter. It's true in spring in a big way. It's true in summer, in particular, along the Gulf Coast, because the nighttime temperatures aren't going to drop. They're going to stay very high. And that has a huge impact on plants, and we can talk about what that means and how to deal with that. It's a pretty good thing to do. Good thing to talk about. So we talked about David's tomato basil pie, which I will tell you, just it's a thing. Tomato basil pie, tomato pie, tomato basil pie is a wonderful thing. And David's got his recipe. I told you a little bit about it. It's on YouTube, and you can look. You can find it by going on YouTube. David helps me to figure all these things out. You go on YouTube and you just look for David Hubbell, H-U-B-B-E-L-L, David Hubbell, David J. Hubbell, David J. Period Hubbell. If you need to be that specific. And David's on Facebook, too, at Melaton Man. If you know how to spell Melaton, you're in good shape. If you don't know how to spell Melaton Man, M-I-R-L-I-T-O-N, Melaton Man of Mobile, or you can go to Hubbell's Hearth, LLC, H-U-B-B-E-L-L, apostrophe S, Hubbell's Hearth, H-E-A-R-T-H, LLC. David's got a lot of good information on there. Great person to follow. If you're, you know, it's one of the best ways to be on Facebook. There are lots of bad ways to be on Facebook, but that's a great way to be on Facebook. Judy, I'm going to get right to you since we lost you last time, and I ran out of time. Tell me what's going on.
I just had some questions about my knockout roses. They're producing plenty of flowers. I would really like them to look full and bushy and not, they're tall and scraggly. Like they're getting long stems on them with the roses on them, but that's all they're doing.
So I'm going to ask you a couple of quick questions. How much sun are these roses getting? Are they getting plenty of sun? Are they
getting
most of the day
of sun.
In sun? Okay, good. Let's go back. So here's the good thing to know. There are a couple of things to know about knockout roses. First is, it's really hard to kill them. And you can abuse them in lots of ways, and they're probably going to survive. And that's good to know, because pruning is a form of abuse. And plants don't actually like to be pruned. They tolerate it, but knockout roses tolerate pruning better than most shrubs, apparently. Okay. The other thing is that knockout roses grow on new growth, not old growth, so you don't have to worry about. They're gonna, as soon as they put on new growth, they're gonna have lots of flowers. So the question is, when do you prune? And I think you could prune now, but here's what I would do. Here's what I would do. Just because you're getting impatient with them, and because you're gonna have a good fall season coming up. In general, the stems that are going to be the tallest and scraggliest are also going to be the thickest ones at the base.
Mm-hmm.
So follow those tall, thick stems down to the base and cut them off about 12 inches high.
Okay.
And let's take three or four of those. Now, the unpleasantness of this is it's a rose and it's got thorns. So you need some long-handled pruning shears to get in there and do it. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
And some gloves, and that would be a way to do it. Now, alternatively, you can wait until, say, winter, or let's wait until January, late January, early February, and just as it's beginning to. Well, let's go late February, and you may be beginning to see it put on new growth. Just cut the whole thing back to 12 inches tall.
Okay.
And that way, you don't have to be judicious.
That's what I did this past year, and then they just grew tall and scraggly instead of growing full. I don't know if I was just not pruning it right or what.
Yeah, so you cut them back 12 inches. Let's cut out those older stems. Let's do that first and see if that doesn't help. So you'll probably have two or three, maybe four older stems that you can just cut out. let's let those newer stems come on and see if that doesn't help a little bit. So cut the older stems back, as you know, down to maybe 6 to 12 inches, and let the others come out and see if that doesn't help.
All right. Well, I'll give that a try.
Yeah, and one other thing, it probably helps to shape them a little bit as you're. If you're taking roses inside, the problem with knockout roses is it's really not very interesting to take the roses inside because they don't smell.
So they lose
one of those great features of roses. It's really sad to have a rose that doesn't smell, but that's what we got. And so people don't take them inside. But if you do take the roses inside, prune off a little bit more of the stems when you take them inside. Just prune down into the bush each time you take a rose off, and that's another way of shaping it. And that's generally what I would suggest. But this time, let's try to take some of those thicker canes out first. And I think those younger canes are going to be a little bushier. Let's try that.
All right. Well, thank you.
All right. You tell me how it works.
All right, I will.
All right. Bill? Well, this is going to be interesting. Tell me what's going on.
I'm at my wit's end. I was hoping to get another crop of corn in this year, and I planted the first night, and they slaughtered me. Something dug up the seeds. The next night, I put a big, thick layer of hay on top. They got it. The next night, I added cayenne into each little seed hole. Didn't matter. The third night, I did the cayenne, or the fourth night or fifth night, and put chicken wire over the top. And whatever it is, it's getting down through it and eating me out of house and home. Do you have any... You got a suggestion?
Yeah. Well, probably several.
Okay.
Let me ask, do you live sort of in a rural area, or do you live in Midtown, or where do you live?
Well, I live in Midtown, but I have a large right-of-way, or should I say jungle, behind me.
Yeah.
So it's on the Oslava Creek. And in between the creek and my house is just extremely thick growth.
Yeah. So I don't think it's voles. I don't think it's meadow voles. Which it can be in the country. It could be meadow voles, V-O-L-E-S.
Uh-huh.
And they're obnoxious, and they can be annoying, and they can dig right through the ground. Do you see any holes at all, or does it look like they uncover the soil and get the seeds, or what do you see?
It looks like they're going right down through the top, and, you know, I'm planting them on six-inch centers, and boy, is it, it's like they're digging.
Yes.
They got my pattern down. They're just...
Yes, so I will tell you, I think the most likely explanation is squirrels.
Uh-huh.
Do you have a lot of squirrels?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it's squirrels. And do you feed the birds?
No. They got plenty to eat around.
Does anybody around you feed? Anybody? Nor does anybody around you. So,
I mean, we got dewberries and just everything around me. The birds do very well.
Yeah, and so it's... I think it's squirrels. It's unusual. It's, you know, you usually don't see a huge concentration of squirrels unless are they moving? Did they just move the chicken wire?
No, they went that's why I was so surprised, you know, because they're like on 1-inch centers or 1-inch holes, and they poked through it and got it. And, you know, my corn is 1.5 inches deep.
Yeah, yeah. I think it's squirrels. It could be a bird, but I think it's squirrels. Birds aren't that efficient. Squirrels are, and squirrels will just go from one to another. It could be raccoons, and raccoons are pretty dexterous.
Yeah.
So the question is, what do you do about it? And let me think about this for just a second, because we're going to take a break, right, and that gives me a chance to think about it before I say something silly. All right. Hold on, Bill. We're going to come back.
I will.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning, Plain Gardening. Bill, I've had time to think about this just a little bit more. You know, I think there are three potential culprits, particularly where you are. And knowing Midtown pretty well and knowing what creatures are there. And the first one is roof rats. It's possible, but roof rats aren't going to go be that hard. They're not going to work that hard for something like corn. The second one is squirrels, and they will do crazy things, particularly if anybody's feeding birds nearby and you got a really huge population. The third one is raccoons, and I should give more thought to raccoons. And raccoons, I'll tell you something about raccoons. Raccoons, for some reason, love corn. I mean, they love corn. They will strip your corn ears off the stalk.
Yeah.
But once they have you had any problem with raccoons doing that?
Yeah, my first crop, and then I was wondering if it was the raccoons, but I always saw rabbits out there, and then I saw rabbits munching on the stalks and the corn. So I did fence
it's probably,
it,
and
it took
it's
care
probably
of the
raccoons.
Problem pretty well.
Yeah, I think raccoons is the answer. And so I think and they are very dexterous. They can get in between, and they are incredibly, they're almost as persistent as squirrels. It's somewhere between squirrels and raccoons. The one thing I can say, and the problem with raccoons is that they love sewers. They love our ditches. And so they are incredibly prolific around ditches and sewers. And they love garbage, and they love they love it when people feed their dogs and cats outside. You'll get tons of them, and we build these huge populations, and it can be very difficult. To satisfy your curiosity, the game cameras don't cost very much. You can just put a game camera out and kind of see what it
Good
is,
idea.
And that'll help you to understand. If the chicken wire isn't working, and it might not work because they have little hands that they can get through chicken wire. And in fact, I've had a raccoon stick his hand through a chicken wire that I had on my chicken cage and grab a chicken. Couldn't get it through the chicken wire, but they grabbed him. So it could well be a raccoon. So, you know, it's going to be a problem now that they know that corn is there. I'm still trying to figure out what to do about raccoons. There are all sorts of old tales about you can do this or that, and I don't know. I mean, I've had a problem with them some years and not a problem with them other years. I can't quite tell what to, you know, how to deal with that.
I even tried a repellent, you know, you get at Home Depot, which had worked pretty good in the past, and no, not this time.
No. Once they figure out the corn's there, there's nothing's going to repel them. And you can use coyote scent, whatever you want. You can use human scent, which people do in various ways, but it isn't going to stop them. And
is there something so powerful that would mask the scent
of the corn?
I don't know how they smell down through the dirt anyway.
Yeah, and that's right. So that's interesting. I think there are lots of scents that you could use to do that. One thing you might But the question is, are they growing around you? One of the things that can grow around you that has a very strong scent is what we call mountain mint, and it has a really strong eucalyptus smell. The other thing you could try is camphor trees, which you know have a really you know camphor trees. Surely you've got them in that little
yes.
Yep, and you know how they smell like camphor.
Yeah,
and you're always trying to get rid of them anyway, and you might try laying them on top of that to see if that hides a scent. Of course, they
you mean
already
like the
know
branches
it's there.
And leaves and things like that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
All right.
And you could see
I'll
if that helps, and that might hide some. Otherwise, you're going to be looking at a very small metal mesh, like hardware cloth, which they can't get their fingers through. But the trouble with hardware cloth is that what are you going to do when the seed emerges, when the seedling emerges?
Well, so that was just, even with the chicken wire.
It takes a degree of ingenuity
seedling,
to figure all this out. Yeah. Raccoons are tough. I'll be thinking about it, but, it would be good to confirm it is raccoons. And again, if anybody is providing any food for raccoons around the house, if you feed your dogs outside, your cats outside, if they can get to your garbage cans, don't do that because that's going to encourage them to come into your yard. And then once they're in and once their population has developed, there's just nothing. You just can't control them.
Yeah. All right. Well, I'm gonna take your advice on that camera. I could use one. I had them out in California, and I'm going to get them now.
All right, Bill. Tell me what you see.
I will. Thank you.
All right.
Bye-bye.
Raccoons. Raccoons. So I did get some support on that from who gave me support on that, Terry. It's a raccoon. And you could, as Terry says, you could look for a track, but I guarantee you got raccoons. There's no question you got raccoons. Everybody in Midtown does. And the closer you are to a sewer or to a creek, the more likely you are to have them. They are everywhere. And the closer you are to somebody who feeds their pets outside, it's not a great thing to do. Not a great thing to do to feed your pets outside. You know, I wish I had a solution for raccoons. I have had a big problem with raccoons in my corn. And then this year, I planted them a different place and not a problem at all. I will tell you that in the past, I had planted my corn close to some woods, close to cover, and close to a neighbor who I hate to say this out loud, who feeds raccoons because it's fun to watch them. Oh. But, you know, people are nice anyway. I mean, I don't think they mean to do bad. It's just they don't think sometimes. And so there's a raccoon problem on one side of the yard. But I planted corn a good bit of distance. I had a little opportunity to plant it at some distance. And I planted it in a place where there's not a lot of cover for them to move from one spot to another. And I didn't have that problem this year. So that's an interesting thing. Now, if you're in Midtown, you're in a small yard, you don't have much choice. You're going to plant it where you can. I'll also say that planting corn this late in the year is going to be a little bit of a problem. You're probably going to run into several problems. I have not been successful planting corn this late, but you can give it a shot. So you're probably not missing much. The corn was probably going to be a big headache anyway. But the raccoons can make it a problem any time of year. Dear me, raccoons. So Ellen said we had, she said she had raccoons, and she trapped them, and they'll pick up the animal and leave another trap for you with the raccoons. The problem is, if you get a lot of them, Ellen said she caught 4 in a year. And you know, Ellen, the only thing I'll say is, if you've got a lot of raccoons, you're going to have more than 4. And that, it just becomes a never-ending trapping session. Dried dog food definitely works as bait. They love it more than corn. So it's a good thing to remember when you're out feeding your dogs on the porch that probably the raccoons are getting most of the feed. Hey, we'll be back.
6 foot, 7 foot, 8 foot bunch.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Through the window, by the window, that's where all bee come tiptoe with the tulips with me.
Oh. Raccoons. And
the garden,
let's move on. That's enough. That's enough. So, raccoons. What? You know, it's a tough one. It's a tough one dealing with raccoons, and I, you just don't want them in the first place. That's the thing. Or you want as few as possible. And it's one of those things. It's one of those creatures we've created. They're one of the tag-alongs, the human tag-alongs. It's too bad because raccoons are kind of neat and they still exist in the wild, but we've created lots of human tag-alongs for raccoons. They figured out, you know, they're pretty smart, and they figured out they can get an easy meal being around humans. It's going to be a bad bargain for them in the long run, I feel like, but meanwhile, it's a pain in the patootie for us. And it's good to change your habits. You know, I said predictable. Predictable is what we are. And if you're thinking about how are you being predictable for raccoons, it's a good thing. Don't feed your dogs outside. Don't leave your garbage. Don't feed your cats outside. The raccoons are going to be all over it. They're going to be all over it. And we build these big populations. We talk about population for just a second. Animals produce offspring and raise offspring to adulthood based on how much food is available. That is the key to understanding population for most creatures. And so it doesn't matter how many you trap, because they're always going to be able to produce more and have more survive to adulthood because there's more food available. And so you have to control the food. The food is the key to controlling pests. If you try to control them at the back end, they're just going to reproduce more quickly. So if you can trap them if you're controlling the food, and then you can make quick work of it. But you got to control the food, and then you can think about trapping. That's the key. That's the key to wildlife. We've created huge populations of raccoons and squirrels and other things, and I can't, you know. so the problem is us. I feel like Ted. Since Ted asked about this native elderberry, man, I just want Ted to find a native elderberry. And, you know, one of the things to look for, Ted, is those white flowers that are probably out right about now in a lot of places. Daryl and Grand Bass call me about elderberries. Just look for those white flowers. They're out there, and you'll see those purple berries forming, and the leaves are compound. What that means is they look like an overgrown fern in a way, because there will be lots of little leaflets on a rachis, on a petiole, on a single stem. And when the leaves fall, the leaves don't fall just one at a time. It's like all those little leaflets fall off in one big clump. That's a compound leaf. Oh, I didn't help you. The stems have lots of lenticels on them, little black dots on the stems. They're brown with little black dots. Stems get really tall. If you think, Ted, that you have seen a picture of a sambucus, of an elderberry, if you think you've seen one in your yard, you send me a photo of it, and I will confirm it for you. How is that? They're really cool. Really cool. Let's see here. Who have we got? Daryl, it's a good time to talk about elderberries, isn't it? Tell me what you're seeing.
We just lost
him. Oh, Daryl, I'm sorry. Give us another try. Lost Daryl. Peanuts, also. Yeah, Michael sent me, is it too early to start broccoli seed and other winter vegetables? Well, no, but I think this is the time to begin ordering the seed. I think it's possible that you could grow some types of broccoli seed now and they would hit at the right time. Here's the key with broccoli. You want to think, when are those days going to get nice and cool? When do the worms, which can be a big problem, when do the worms cease being a problem? And that's usually, for me, that's about the last week in September along the Gulf Coast. It's a little later farther inland. It's a little earlier farther inland. A little earlier farther inland. If you're up around, if you're in the middle part of the state, by mid-September, you're okay. You may be okay to have your broccoli ready to go outside. So here's the key. You're going to start the seed. You want the plants to be nice and big when you put them outside on the last week in September if you're on the Gulf Coast. So what does that mean? That means about 6 weeks. About 6 weeks, maybe 7 weeks is okay. Maybe 8 weeks. So sometime around the 1st of August to the middle of August. I don't think on the Gulf Coast there's any reason to start them sooner. It is a good reminder that those farther north need to start thinking about their broccoli really soon. Really soon. In order to get the plants big enough that they can have them ready to go out the end of September or the middle of September if you're much farther north. Does that help? However, and I'll also say, radishes. I start planting my radishes. You can start planting them the first week in August. Plant them in the ground directly. They are really heat tolerant. They'll come on up, and they'll be ready to produce as the days shorten and the winter cools off. So winter radishes, great thing to do then. And some other things that we can grow. If you have any other questions about winter vegetables, you give me a call. I can't think of anything that has to be planted in July, but there are lots of things you need to start purchasing the seed for, so you'll be ready to get them started in pots in August. In August, that's the time to do it. July is still time. You still have time to plant more okra. You still have time to plant more peas. If you have a nice tall tomato plant, got a nice tall tomato plant in a pot, it looks really good. You could plant that tomato plant out and see how it does. You could still get eggplants. You could still get peppers. And one of the things I do, I'll tell you, in July and August, is start peppers. Reason I do that is because it's so easy to start them in July and August. The heat's right. You just put them outside. They're just fine. They grow really well. And then I overwinter them. I don't put them directly in the ground. I overwinter them and get them ready to plant in the ground in March if the soil's warm enough. And then I've got peppers really early. Now, this works really well. It should work with any pepper, but it works particularly well with some of the ahis we talk about. Really great way to grow them. So you can start them now. Start them in a container. Put them in a little bigger. Graduate them into larger and larger containers. And it's just a great way to do it. It's a really wonderful way to do it. Let's see here. Velvet beans. I don't know much about velvet beans, I'll tell you. I just don't know. I can tell you about, let me talk about something I know, Rob, which is winged beans. And winged beans, and they're a great crop and really easy to grow. Look up winged beans. It's a tropical bean, and it's something we probably ought to use more along the Gulf Coast. I've been using it for a while. You want a day-neutral winged bean, and there are several people now selling them. Day-neutral winged beans. Kitazawa is selling day-neutral winged beans, which means that they start producing in midsummer. You don't have to wait until fall for them to produce. But winged beans are a great crop for the Gulf Coast. Velvet beans, I don't know as much about. I don't know why I don't know about velvet beans. Maybe I should know about velvet beans. I see the name passed around here and there, and I basically ignored it. That's the honest to goodness truth. That's the honest to good truth. Turmeric, beautiful picture. Beautiful picture there, Rob. Let's see. Butter beans. Ellen, so is it too late for butter beans? You know, I think it may be just a little too late, but you can give it a try, particularly the pole butter beans. They do well planted late. I will say this on the Gulf Coast. I think planting butter beans in May and June is great. It may be a little bit late for July. You can give it a shot. I think you might do okay. I think generally May or June is a better time for butter beans. If you're planting bush butter beans, which I don't have a lot of experience with because I think they take up a lot of space and you don't get much out of them, it's probably okay to plant the bush butter beans now. Probably, in fact, it might be a good time to plant bush butter beans. But poles are what you want. And I think you can give it a try. I'm not going to guarantee it because you're going to get kind of clipped at the end. It's a little tight. June would be my preferred time. I think I've said that before. So I'm a little worried it's going to be a little bit late. The best way to plant fall tomatoes. What type of plant is better? Blossom end rot is going to be a big problem if you're growing them in containers. And it is always a big problem, and it's a big problem because of fluctuations in soil moisture. So one way to get around that if you're growing them in containers is to grow them in a bigger pot so that there is there are fewer extremes in soil moisture, or remember to water promptly. It can be hard to manage things in pots. We'll come back and talk about those fall tomatoes here in just a little bit.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. Gulf Coast, Sunday morning. Got a little bit of time left. Going to try to clean up some stuff. Fall tomatoes. The best way to plant fall tomatoes. You know, I certainly think it could be smart to grow fall tomatoes in a container if the container is large enough, and that way you can move the plant around in case we get some late frost and perhaps prolong the harvest. But I will tell you that the one downside of that is the days get a lot shorter. And so things develop very slowly. This is probably your last chance to do really think about fall tomatoes. Which varieties you don't want a variety that takes a long time to produce. I would say for fall tomatoes, it's particularly important to think about tomatoes that produce in a relatively short window. And given the pests and other things, I also think it's good to have pretty vigorous things. I think some of the smaller tomatoes are really great. I've got a whole list of small tomatoes that I love. Some of them are a little harder to find. Jim in Georgetown is going to always remind me that I should tell you about Matt's Wild Cherry, which is a great one. It'll do great for fall. And it'll produce just fine. Mexico Midget, but there's some slightly bigger ones too. There are bigger ones like Prado Cortez, which I really love. A great tomato, and Santiago, and another new one that I found called Rignon. R-I-N-O-N, which is very good. And there's a bunch of them. The good thing about fall is that as long as the tomato is fairly vigorous, it's going to be coming into the cooler weather. It's not going to be as hot when the fruit forms. And that's the really great part about that. That's the really great part, is that you'll have the cooler weather. The young plant will grow through this hot weather. Does that help? And you call me next week and we'll talk about how to put them in a container. Look for your plants this week. We'll talk about how to put them in. And if you're going to do it, if you want to put them in the ground, we'll talk about how to put them in the ground so that you don't get tomato wilt. But that's something you got to prepare for. Take a little while to make that work. It's going to take a little while to make that work. So we'll talk more about that. What else do I need to talk about? Can I recommend varieties of broccoli? That is a great question. I'm going to talk about that next week in a little more detail. Just give me until next week. Broccoli, cabbage varieties, radish varieties. You betcha. I'm going to talk about that next week. It'll be closer to the time, and we'll be thinking about them. It's a really interesting question because a lot of the hybrids that have worked well for broccoli aren't on the market anymore. And I've got to go back to square one on some varieties. It irritates the stew out of me. It's a problem with hybrid varieties. Is somebody decides, oh, well, it only does well in Alabama. We don't want to keep growing that thing. That's the way it is. And so you can't grow a hybrid yourself. You can't save the seed on it. So you're stuck. So I've been thinking about other types of broccolis that do well for us. And I'll tell you, I've got some new ideas. Y'all remind me to talk about broccoli next week. We got some new ideas, some new thoughts on broccoli for things that are probably going to do a lot better for us. Than some of the conventional varieties. Cabbages, I always have a tough time with cabbage. Cabbage can be tricky. I don't think the long-season cabbages do that well. We have just a little bit of time, and Linda's going to ask a question that's going to make me say Linda's going to have to call back. But, Linda, let's get started now. You want to resod your grass? Linda.
Can you hear me?
I can hear you. Okay. Tell me, you're thinking about resodding?
I want to resod my grass. I have every weed known to mankind. And I'm getting conflicting advice on what type to use, whether zoysia or centipede. And I understand there are two types of zoysia. It's been suggested one of my neighbors used Palisade zoysia, and it looks beautiful. And then another one used El Toro, and it looks beautiful. But then I hear centipede is the lazy man's grass, and that appeals to me. So I'm kind of looking for some guidance here.
Centipede is not lazy man's grass. Centipede will drive you absolutely crazy. No grass is going to solve your weed problem. And we'll talk about that. You could probably go with what you've got. And it would be nice to know what you've got and what kind of weeds you've got. But the grass isn't going to get rid of your weeds. How you maintain that yard is going to get rid of your weeds. The only grass I'd say that you don't want to plant if you've had weed problems in the past is centipede. I promise, I will put money on the fact that you will have weeds abundantly in centipede, because centipede is a lazy man's grass, and it's lazy. It doesn't compete well with weeds. It doesn't grow very fast. It doesn't need fertilizer. I could go on with a lot of things, but it's easy for all the wrong reasons. It's lazy for all the wrong reasons. So you don't want to use centipede. Or you can do it, and then you'll call me next year and say, what do I do about this? And I say, well, don't plant centipede.
Okay.
The zoysia, the new zoysias that are tall are okay. They're fine. They're not perfect. No grass is perfect. I have seen them do quite well. I've seen some varieties do better than others. You do not want a fine-bladed zoysia. You want the new thicker-bladed zoysias that have thicker blades, and you want to be able to mow them high. If you don't mow high, you will have weed problems. And that's the virtue of some of the newer varieties of zoysia. St. Augustine can work very well, too, because you can mow it high. So the key here is mowing high. Before I invested in resodding, which you definitely don't want to do this time of year, definitely do not want to do this time of year. Before I invested in resodding, because it's a major effort, and it's going to be harder than you think it is, I would figure out what kind of sod you got now, figure out what kind of grass you got, and then talk to me about
everything.
How... Yeah. Well, how high are you mowing it? How high are you mowing it?
My grass is Bahia grass.
Bahia. Yeah, that will drive you crazy.
It does.
It is. Yeah. So, because of the stems coming up and the little antennas coming up, Bahia will outcompete any weed. I don't think you have any weed in your grass except for Bahia.
well, and it's Bahia a weed.
Yeah, that's right. So it's going to be hard to get rid of the Bahia. Are you sure that Bahia is the dominant grass?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Then you probably had centipede to start with, and you've probably mowed in a way that probably encouraged that. But you call me back, because now is not the time, and we're going to run out of time to talk about it, but now is not the time to resod, I promise. The time to resod is in October, November, and it's a perfect time to resod, but you need to do a little bit of prep to your soil before then. So the 1st of September, last of August, 1st of September, you call me back, and I'm going to give you step-by-step instructions how to do that.
Okay, great.
Is that good?
Thank you so much for taking my call.
All right, thank you. Well, look at that. We're going to be back next week. Save your questions up. We'll talk a little bit more about elderberry. Sweet love back.